First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the contributions that Dr. David Dannbaum made to this presentation. He was commissioned by the dean at the centennial of the Ag Experiment Station to write the book, Our Purpose is to Serve. And so I leaned very heavily on his information as I wrote and prepared this talk. Fargoans were ambivalent about the prospects of having a land-grant institution in their city in 1883, and that ambivalence endured in 1889 when the North Dakota Constitutional Convention got down to the business of passing out institutions. While the city obviously wanted something, there was no question that Fargoans were able to contain their enthusiasm about being the home of the Ag College and Experiment Station. Fargo actually had the Ag College thrust upon it its wishes to the contrary. But on May 15, 1890, the Board of Trustees of the North Dakota Ag College and Experiment Station created on paper the Agricultural Experiment Station. The location of the station in the Red River Valley meant that the field experiments were of questionable validity for most of the state. Had the ag scientists been consulted, they might have urged placement of the station further west in a drift prairie site. The location of the station on the Minnesota border also made it remotely isolated for much of the state. A more central location would have facilitated contacts between the station and its agricultural constituents. In the summer of 1890, the board hired Claire Waldron, a horticulturalist, and on October 15th confirmed as its first firm president Horace E. Stockbridge, chemist Edwin Ladd, and botanist Henry Luke Bolley. Stockbridge was a strong proponent of practical work at the early Ag Experiment Station. With Edward Ladd in the vanguard, the station undertook an ambiguous program of regulatory work to protect the public interest. The Office of Experiment Station did not consider regulatory work, such as Ladd did with foods and paints and Bolley did with seeds, to be appropriate functions for the scientific institution, and it refused to allow expenditures of federal funds for such purposes. On the other hand, by responding to the needs of a broadly conceived public constituency, the station made itself important to North Dakota. And as Dannbaum put it, the North Dakota Agricultural Experiment Station probably exerted more profound influence than did any other such station in the United States. The Ag Experiment Station was a significant factor in the life of the state, and public interest research was a large part of that effort. In 1914, there were 38 on the station roster in Fargo and 7 elsewhere in the state. Facilities were expanded as well, though never fast enough for an energetic young scientist who could always see more to do. One major addition to the station was the enhancement of its ability to serve the state were substations, later renamed branch stations, and subsequently research extension centers. Edgley, in 1903, gave the experiment station a drift prairie location. Dickinson, in Stark County in 1905, allowed work in the semi-arid west. Williston and Langdon, 2 years later in 1907, and Hettinger in 1909. As Dannbaum points out, in 1913, the Ag Experiment Station was a vibrant component of a young and growing state. Its research regulations touched every man, woman, and child in the state. Its major figures were widely respected and even loved in the state. Its growth and stature had been paralleled by increasing political strength and independence and by dramatic advances in appropriations and number of personnel. As Dannbaum says so eloquently, there is a tragic pattern in the affairs of men that is repeated so regularly that it is almost be classified as an essential component of the human condition. At our moment of greatest strength and success, at the instant of our most remarkable triumph, our downfall begins. So it was with the Ag Experiment Station. In 1913, Henry Bawley proposed a theory that the decline in wheat yields were due at least in part to what he called wheat-poor soils, which he attributed to presence of microorganisms in the soil due to continuous wheat-on-wheat cropping and the use of untreated seed. This revelation frightened and angered the businessmen who relied on wheat for their living, elevator operators, bankers, millers, and the railroads. Bawley had already angered this group once before when he showed through research that the elevators were overly downgrading wheat due to minute amounts of rust. To counteract this research, the businessmen formed the Better Farming Association, which advocated better business management and the use of fertilizers to improve wheat yields and farm profits. In late 1913, the director of the Ag Experiment Station resigned his post to concentrate his efforts on the presidency and to run for the U.S. Senate. In a politically motivated move, the Board of Trustees, dominated by businessmen, named the new director with ties to business interests in the Twin Cities. This further angered and alienated the producers and some researchers at the Ag Experiment Station. The controversy continued to grow with results of taking sides within the Ag Experiment Station and those people forcing their subordinates to take sides as well. As Dan Baum indicated in his book, this permeated the research center and it lasted until the very last of those people either moved on or retired. One was O.A. Stevens, who retired about two or three years before I came to work for NDSU. It lasted a long time. And as Dan Baum indicated in a conversation with me last week, he said, it was really good science, but really poor politics. In the end, Bawley and his supporters prevailed, but not without a good deal of turmoil. Over the 39 staff members on the rolls in January of 1914, only five were still listed in 1919. In essence, only the major figures at the station stayed during these trying times. The formation of the Nonpartisan League, which had its roots in western North Dakota, swept the 1916 elections and shortly thereafter formed a state-owned elevator and a state-owned bank. And I believe that North Dakota is the only state that has a state-owned bank. To add to these miseries, the total state and federal appropriations for agriculture experiment stations had doubled the 5 years up until 1914. Between 1914 and 1919, they rose hardly at all. The situation was rendered especially serious by the dramatic inflation of that period. As H.L. Walster wrote in 1936, the Great Plains might well be defined as the area of stress and strain. They have been, and probably always will be, the stage upon which the American people will try their greatest social and economic experiments. They will continue to be the stage upon which Mother Nature will reveal herself with the greatest variety of moods, ranging from sumptuous plenty in the bountiful years to scarcity in the years of drought, hot winds, grasshoppers, rust, and other diseases. The relative decline in agriculture was greater than it was in industry, and North Dakota was an overwhelmingly agricultural state. Wheat was hit harder than most crops, and North Dakota was a wheat state. In the last 3 years of the 20s, North Dakota farmers harvested an average of nearly 73 million bushels of hard red spring wheat and nearly 57 million bushels of durum. From 1934 through 36, production for hardware spring wheat dropped 70% to 21.6 million bushels and 80% to 10.1 million bushels for durum. As Dan Boyne points out, the Ag Experiment Station was not the only experiment station to suffer financial stringency, but its hardship was much more by degree. It had been closer to the margins than most when the Depression began, and it was cut more than most during the course of the 30s. Salaries were slashed, funds for equipment were reduced virtually to nothing, and researchers who left were not replaced. In 1933, the legislature slashed appropriations to the Ag College by 59% and to the experiment station by even more. State appropriations were reduced 88% between one budget period and another. As agronomist Ted Stoa remembered, it was a tough time, a discouraging time. Morale was low, absolutely. Following the Depression, farmers seemed more appreciative of what science could do for them. More of them cherished the station and its activities on their behalf. They seemed to appreciate the scientists and the loyalty of those people in the state. For its part, the station relearned the importance of serving the public's needs and of maintaining a favorable public image. As the 30s receded into the past, the North Dakota Ag Experiment Station increasingly found itself where it had always wanted to be. Getting there was the hard part. In 1939, the station released two new wheat varieties, which were moderately resistant to both stem and leaf rust and capable of good yields. The station improved its political position, was reflected in rising appropriations. The problem was that the appropriations had been so drastically low that even dramatic increases didn't provide a lot of money for the work. One legislative priority was the reopening of the substations, all but one of which had been essentially shut down during the 30s. The main station had been ambivalent about these entities ever since the early teens. The USDA suggested that the state had too many and urged them not to reopen them. But as the director wrote in response, "I appreciate the forcefulness of your argument which you set forth in respect to concentrating our facilities at the Fargo station. But if we fail to do something of special character, such as irrigation work for the people of the Northwest, this is the very place we are going to lose the necessary legislative support which we must have in order to support the entire station." The 1940s and 50s were a golden age for publicly sponsored agriculture research in the United States. The North Central Research and Extension Center was established in 1945 with the donation of a former poor farm south of Minot. During the 30s, many students of public policy had wondered whether, in light of the developments that seemed to increase production, and it took no less a figure than Adolf Hitler to change the attitude. For those in public research system, the most remarkable aspect of World War II was the dramatic turnabout it brought in the popular American attitude towards agricultural science. For those in the public system, a short while ago, some people felt agricultural science had done its work too well, noted USDA researcher Administrator F.C. Archer in 1942. But today, there is no doubt that in anyone's mind of the need for agricultural science to feed vast armies, clothe, and keep them healthy. In 1960, the Carrington Irrigation Station was established to accommodate the expected demand from the formation of the Garrison Diversion. This was a system that was to bring irrigation water from the Missouri River across eastern North Dakota. In 1968, Director Arlen Hazen wrote, "Within the past 15 years, the Agricultural Experiment Station has about doubled in size in terms of budget, personnel, and activities. Even with the inflationary factor applied, the budget's growth has been noteworthy. We expect to continue to grow at a rate of 10 to 20% into the immediate future to take care of the rapidly increasing needs of North Dakota agricultural industry for basic knowledge and interpretation." Another important change came in 1972 when the State Board of Higher Education agreed to create a special board to consult it on matters related to the station and extension. The Board of Higher Education represented a vast improvement over the highly politicized Board of Administration that preceded it. It was not, however, a perfect instrument for setting agricultural research policies and priorities. The members were, and are, drawn from many walks of life in the state and different occupations. Sometimes they know something about agriculture, but most of the time they do not. This situation, which is a constant irritate to the station and its champions, came to a head in 1972 when Castleton farmer George Sinner joined the board. Sinner remembers, as a farmer, I was expected to know everything about research and extension. He refused to bear the burden and suggested the establishment of an agricultural consultation board. There was and is a problem inherent in any consultation body that it can advise but cannot execute. A one-time consultation board member, Kelly Miller, puts it, there's a woman here in Towner who has an old tomcat who used to go out at night and come back all beat up. She had him fixed. Now he still goes out at night, but he just consults. The consultation board has not been perfect from anybody's standpoint, and there are those who do not believe that the State Board of Higher Education should have any control over agriculture and extension. Still, it provides a means that did not previously exist for groups to researchers to have some say in setting the budgets and policies of the Board of Higher Education members to learn something about research systems and its needs. The board met representatives of commodity groups for their suggestions and received presentations and made investigations of the station, at times urging change in direction and, in the end, some research. It then made suggestions regarding funding and policy making to the Board of Higher Education. Former Governor William Guy, who belonged to the first consultation board, believes the members always had a problem with realizing where their authority began and ended, and thus behaved presumptuously at times. For its part, the State Board of Higher Education was not always receptive to its advisory body and sometimes seemed resentful. Perhaps the board members saw the consultants as raiders on the treasury and feared they would overstep their board authority. By the early 80s, North Dakota agriculture was suffering as it had not suffered since the terrible years of the drought of the Depression half a century before. The reason for the agriculture collapse and the ensuing depression are complex. Part of the problem was rising world food supplies and the subsequent softening of prices. Then there was the Ford and Carter embargoes on grain sales to the Soviet Union, which brought into question the reliability of our as a supplier. In 1979, the Federal Reserve Board decided to fight inflation with higher interest rates, a policy that succeeded eventually, but at a cost of slowing the economy. High interest rates and a heavy borrowing to finance budget deficits initiated by the Reagan administration resulted in a rapid repatriation of dollars and a dramatic rise in the relative value of American currency. Overvalued dollar suffocated American exports, among which agricultural products are primary. The effects of these complicated developments on agriculture in North Dakota and elsewhere were catastrophic. Prices plunged, interest rates stayed high, but inflation, the debtor's strongest ally, dropped significantly. That extravagant hopes were turning to gloom was reflected in plummeting land prices. Land in southern Red River Valley dropped 16% in 1 year. And between 1981 and 1985, agricultural land prices in North Dakota dropped by over 26%. During the 60s and 70s, with rising budgets and new researchers were hired, in the 70s, the Ag Experiment Station was expanded with the establishment of the Central Grasslands Research Extension Center in the Coteau and the addition of the Manning Ranch at the Dickinson Research and Extension Center. As the downturn of the 80s and 90s saw the experiment station unable to continue to grow and take on new research, administrators made promises that they were unable to keep. In addition, the Ag Experiment Station was caught somewhat off guard by the rapid increase of the Fusarium head blight, the increased acres of corn in the eastern part of the state, and the conversion from plow, packer, drill technology to the new no-till or minimum till, leaving the straw and the spores on the surface of the land. Grain producers were angry and blamed the Ag Experiment Station for not being on top of the situation. They wanted more money. They thought that more money should be immediately diverted from ongoing research into wheat breeding and pathology work. What happened next maybe could best be defined as Kelly Miller's neighbor got herself a new cat. In 1997, the legislative decree, the State Board of Agricultural Research, was established out of the old Consultation Board to be responsible for budgeting and policy making associated with the supervision of the North Dakota Ag Experiment Station. In 1999, it was changed to include oversight over extension and renamed the State Board of Agricultural Research and Education, SBAER. The membership of SBAER includes five producers appointed by the Ag Coalition. This is a group of ag commodity groups in the state of North Dakota. Five persons are appointed from the Extension Services multi-program units. The president of North Dakota State University, or his or her designee, and two members of the Legislative Assembly appointed by the Legislative Council. Non-voting members include the Vice President for Agriculture and Research, the Directors of Extension and Research, and the North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner. The major duties of the State Board of Ag Research and Education include developing with the Ag Experiment Station and Extension Service an annual budget for the appropriation of these entities. Develop a biennial budget request and submit the request to the President of North Dakota State University and to the Board of Higher Education. To maximize the use of existing financial resources, equipment, and facilities to generate the greatest economic benefit from research and extension efforts and to promote efficiency. Annually evaluate the results of research and extension activities and expenditures and report the findings to the Legislative Council and to the State Board of Higher Education. Advise the President of North Dakota State University regarding the recruitment, selection, and performance of the Vice President of Agriculture and University Extension and the Directors of Research and Extension. And lastly, present a status report to the budget section of the Legislative Council. Now, to say that there wasn't a lot of consternation in the Research and Extension Center is, and at the main station when this was suggested and put into practice is a understatement. It has turned out to be probably a very good thing for North Dakota agriculture. The legislators put these people in place, and now they can't ignore what they have to say. So when they bring a budget request, as they did in the last biennium, which was nearly 20% increase in funding for agriculture, most of it got approved. There have still been some end runs around by politicians and local supporters who want a certain project for their commodity group or their research and extension center, but for the most part, it has been very effective. It was a steep learning curve for the people who served on this board, but fortunately, the first chair of the board was a person who understood where their place should be and didn't overstep and overpush their authority. So they very rarely make any decisions about personnel, about programs they could eliminate. They found out, as you might expect, that while each one of them had a particular commodity group to support, they learned that all the other commodity groups had their particular research project that they wanted to support. I believe the legislators expected them to remove programs, but after a thorough review, they came to the conclusion that there really wasn't any waste, and that most of the research programs were only one deep, and they have pressed the legislators to increase funding in some of those areas. To wrap up, I'd like to bring you a little philosophy from an old friend and mentor, Tom Conlon, who wrote several years ago in a bi-monthly bulletin. It has been my observation that researchers at branch stations attract a special kind of person. Part-time farmer, part-time livestockman, part-time mechanic, part-time extension specialist, part-time public relations man, and full-time agricultural scientist. Thank you.